I wonder where Ted Lefroy was in 1989. He's the director of the Center for Environment and pops in every now and then with some fascinating provocation, and we're going to talk about seeds today. But Ted, morning.
Morning, Rick.
Where were you? 1989. Did you see it as the, you know, the final triumph of liberal capitalism, as the freeing of the world, the end of terror?
I was too far from the big smoke. I was living in I was in a caravan park in Hopetoun.
Crikey!
Yeah.
Oh, now I want to know all about that. What took you there?
What took me there? I was working on the south coast near Esperance, and we were experimenting with different sorts of farming systems because of the problems they were having with wind erosion, salinity. We thought we'd try something radically different.
How did it go?
Well, it sort of went all right. There's between 50 and 100,000 hectares of what they call alley farming now, which is where you grow crops between belts of trees, which would be between 30 to, say, 100 metres apart, depending on the height of the tree. The idea is that they manage water tables, they stop erosion, they protect the crop. Sounded like a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
Except that every square metre of land displaced by the tree, you lose income. And in water-limiting environments, competition rules and the trees tend to win. So there's a cost.
Curses.
Yeah, exactly.
On paper, that sounds brilliant.
I know, doesn't it?
And this is the problem with new ideas about farming.
It is, yeah.
Is that until you scale them up, because they might even work on a small scale, but until you scale them up to industrial size, you don't know if it works.
Exactly, exactly.
And this might then prove the death of this bold new idea, which, if it does work, though, will prove the death of the seed companies, the big multinationals.
Yeah.
So what's this idea that's getting out
the
about
idea
at
is
the moment?
Perennial grain crops. And it was an idea in the febrile brain of one American ecologist called Wes Jackson. 1977, he was teaching ecology at the University of Sacramento, and he decided in disgust there was really only one degree being offered by this university, and that was upward mobility, and that the ideas of sustainability were being so watered down, he was going to start from scratch. So he quit his job. He bought a couple of hundred acres of prairie in Kansas, his native state, where he grew up on a farm, and he set about trying to develop a farming system that was based as a mimic of the prairie, which is a mixture of perennial plants. And so,
can you just define perennial plant for me, for those people who are going, oh, which one is that?
Plants that live for a long time, as opposed to most of our crops, wheat, rice, corn, are annuals. You plant them. They flower, they set seed, or they die. You harvest them and you plant them next year. So a perennial is one that you plant once and it lives for a very long time. And the idea being that you plant it once and you keep harvesting the grain. And there's a fundamental problem that ecologists and botanists raised, and that is that you either have perenniality or high seed yield. You can't have both. But there's a trade-off in nature.
So the problem with perennials is that they're small and tougher.
Well, no,
generally.
they put their energy into a deep root system, a permanent crown that can survive over winter in the Northern Hemisphere or can survive our summer, and that's where they put their starts. Mm. That's where they put their resources into living long, not producing lots of seed. And it's really taken them about 30 years, and the breakthrough came when they employed a plant breeder out of the United States Department of Agriculture, Stan Cox, and a couple of other geneticists. And it's only in the last few years they've published a series of papers showing that this so-called trade-off in nature is not strictly true, that you can have high seed yield and perenniality. And they've released so far one grain called Kernza, K-E-R-N-Z-A, that is now commercially available and it's a perennial. And I've been to a meeting there. This is at the Land Institute in Kansas. And at that meeting, we ate bread made from Kernza and we drank beer made from Kernza. And so there was a quiet celebration. But their agenda is to have rice, sorghum, barley, rye, corn, to breed all of those as perennial crops, grain crops.
20 to 7 on 936 ABC Hobart. You're listening to the director of the Centre for Environment at UTAS, Ted Lefroy, part of a series of provocative ecological Mondays. Now, surely if this happens, the seed companies, the annual seed companies, either are going to want to get hold of that intellectual property very quickly and control it, or they're going to be sending some, you know, guys out in black Ford Territory with black clothes to take them out.
Well, this is a very long-term vision. And the fellow that started it in 1977 said, if you think you'll see the results in your lifetime, you're not thinking big enough. Now, he's now 78. He doesn't think he'll see it in his lifetime, but it is a long-term vision. And it, in a way, it's a race against time, because for annual crop production, there's a very heavy reliance on fossil fuels in the form of diesel, fertilizer, and pesticide. So the conviction of this group is that these are not going to feed the world in 20 or even 30 years. But if and when we don't have access to those high level of inputs and perennial grains come into their own, they'll be ready. They would have had 50 years of crop breeding. Now, whether those big companies, Monsanto, Dow, Syngenta, whether they're still around and still in the same business, who knows? Maybe we'll have an alternative transport fuel. But if we don't, then these perennial crops will have a niche. If not a niche, something even bigger.
Because farming them must be just such a different experience.
It is.
Presumably you just put them in and then try and keep pests off them.
Yeah, and that's a big problem, because one of the things is the pest burden, especially things like rust. And a lot of wheat growers, for instance, in Kansas are nervous about this perennial wheat kernza, because it's there every year, all year. And if it succumbs to rust, then it's going to harbour the rust from one year to the next and pass it on to their crop. So, you know, but the interesting thing is what's really given them a boost are the latest techniques in genetics and plant breeding. So they're using all of those to understand the genome of wheat and rice and corn and understand what perenniality really means.
So they can change these normally annual crops into perennial crops, they think?
Well, what they've done is found perennial relatives. So, for instance, sorghum has a perennial relative. Anybody who's been to Queensland would have seen a thing called Johnson grass growing at the side of the road, which is a real pest because it has rhizomes. And you can slash it, you can do what you like with it, but it'll just keep coming back. Well, it's a relative of sorghum. And what they've done is just, if this crossed annual sorghum with Johnson grass, and they've got a high-yielding plant that has rhizomes and lives forever. But there's this delicate balance between when does it become a weed and a pest, and when does its grain yield mean that it tips over that balance and becomes useful. One of the most interesting developments, though, is in China, where upland perennial rice, has now got serious backing from the Chinese government, because there are parts of rural China where the labour force is so reduced because people have gone to the city that it's left to women to plant the crop, and there just isn't enough labour to put it in. So though they're really getting behind the idea of a perennial upland rice, because the idea that you plant it once and you harvest it each year, and their yields have been the most rapid increase and perhaps the most promising of all the perennial grains. So there's breeding programs now in the USA and Canada, Sweden, Italy, South Africa and China.
Imagine the change to people's lives, though, who are the rice farmers in terms of what that might mean. I mean, one danger is it might mean less work, which could be terrible for people in poor countries. But if you can get a food yield increased like that from less labour, then it might create more wealth.
Well, exactly. And I think at the moment, you know, there are yields that are 70 to 80% that of the annual from a perennial, which is exciting. But their vision is even bolder than that, because the way they've done this is to try and develop an agriculture that mimics natural ecosystems. And in a natural ecosystem, you very rarely find a monoculture. So their vision is actually what they call perennial polycultures. So you have multiple grains plus legumes, providing them with their nitrogen out of the atmosphere, in this system that you still disturb occasionally by grazing. And in fact, on the Land Institute, they have a herd of bison. And you can go out onto the Conza Prairie and you see their bison grazing this perennial polyculture. They graze it down to a certain point, then take them off, and then it comes up to seed. And the idea is that then you harvest these multiple grains. Now,
and then you can sell hunting licenses to people to hunt, the, like we do with our deer here, the bison. What was happening, Ted Lefroy, that's very flippant of me, in the 1970s that these ideas came out? Because I'm thinking of Bill Mollison here with permaculture in Tasmania. I mean, these were visionary ideas about how to treat food differently. What was going so badly wrong in the 70s? Or was it just because The Good Life was on television and everyone was thinking about living differently?
There are a couple of things. A big one was the price of fuel. Remember the fuel shock?
Yeah, we had carless days.
That's right.
Everyone had stickers on their cars, the Thursday and Wednesday.
Yeah, and highways in America, believe it or not, had speed limits, you know, and the speed limit came down. Smaller cars started coming out. But that was engineered by OPEC, it turns out. But it kind of prepared everybody. It was a bit of a shock to the system. And that's when we had a lot of people rethinking the way we did lots of things, transport, agriculture. So that was a stimulus, but that idea hasn't died. It's just outside the formal culture. It's subterranean, and their fervent hope is it'll be ready when the time comes.
And without those visionaries, if the time does come and that stuff is ready to roll out, then it'll be a bump rather than a famine.
Exactly.
Global famine.
Yeah.
How amazing. Does that mean, though, with people like that doing that kind of thinking, that we shouldn't panic about sustainability because the work is constantly going on in the background to make sure we can sustain ourselves, even if there's the oil crisis?
I don't think we should panic about anything. You don't think clearly when you panic. But I think what it shows is that you need a whole palette, a spectrum of different approaches, because who knows what the future's going to throw at us. So this one might seem extremely radical. It seemed to contradict some basic tenets of biology, but they've plugged away for 38 years and they've demonstrated the idea has some legs, but it's probably another 30 before it's commercial. So we need to work on all fronts.